Hi.
Oh, hello there, Luke. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Bald and beautiful.
You are bald and beautiful. What made you want to borderline pick your head?
So, a couple things. One, I've always thought about doing it, but, you know, the weird, like, divots in the bumpy head. And I was seeing this thing how, like, well, if you use this type of electric trimmer for a head, it actually, like, will, like, really lessen the severity because, like, it can get to the hairs that, like, normal razor can't.
Okay.
So I'm going to do that tomorrow. I'm just going to see if I like it. I've got my cousin's wedding is, like, 3 weeks. So this gives me just enough time that if it's not a good fit, it'll grow back to a point where it looks fine. So, and I trimmed the beard too, just because I needed to kind of like I screwed up one little like sideburn and it looked a little bit weird. So I wanted to like kind of reset my beard almost. So it's really short here and it's really short, but it's intentional because this will grow. This will go like on my right beneath the chin and the neck to the length that I want. So yeah. So let's see how it goes.
I want you to go for full George Lucas when it comes to your beard, like grow just the jawline.
If I could go full George Lucas in my bank account and in my jawline, I'd be thrilled. If that's what it takes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you too. Saw you last night, but you know.
I know. It's just good to see you.
It's good to see you. It's good to talk. It's good to be with you. It's good to be here, everyone.
My daughter said to me, I want to watch a movie. So like, you know, this thing with kids and age, right? Everything's about age. I forget how much kids obsess about age, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, she's 11, but he's 12. Oh yeah, he might be 12, but I'm 10, but I'm 1 inch taller than him. Or, you know, they play these like funny, you know, I'm 11 and a half.
As Everly says, 3, not 4.
Exactly. So the funny thing with that is they're always trying to do things. And I forget this. I forget the Seinfeld bit where when you're a kid, everything is up. Hold up, shut up, grow up, right? Like, everything is up.
Man up.
And then when you become an adult, everything is down. Slow down, you know, whatever. So she said she wanted to watch a World War II movie, and she probably wanted to watch Saving Private Ryan.
Like, but, sign me up. Yeah. Are you ready to see a guy who found his arm? Here we go.
Yeah, here we go, kid. So we started looking through about 15 or 20 different movies. Like, what would be a good World War II movie that whose shocking display of realistic violence would have the proper reaction, which is the feels of sympathy and the horror of war, not like, oh, wow, that's gross and I'm going to have a nightmare about that. But like, you hurt because people that you love who are real humans are hurting, right? Mm-hmm. And we decided on Band of Brothers, one, because the younger kids were playing outside, and I wanted her to really understand Band of Brothers. Like, these were real people. I wanted them to see the men in the beginning of each episode and stuff. And I didn't, you know, like, I didn't realize at the time, like, obviously it was an intentional thing not to put their names there, just to hear them talk.
Mm-hmm.
And then you figure out who they are at the end, and you guess, and that's part of the joy of the show. Of like the actor really taking on their personality, like gonorrhea. I love that guy.
So great. Great actor too.
Yeah. Tonight's episode was called The Replacements.
Oh, so you're that far.
Yeah. So we watched four episodes. Okay. So back to back, we watched the first two because Kurahi is boring if you're a, you know, 13-year-old girl.
You can't appreciate the weirdness of seeing David Schwimmer in that role.
Yeah, I know. So this is easy company. It's like the scene that stands out to me, and I'm like, all right, Schwimmer. More Sobel, less Schwimmer. But I love him. I love his character because he just looks like a jerk you want to punch.
Yeah.
But so we watched the first two, and then last night or the night before, we watched the third. And that's where, you know, that's hard. Like, these are just such hard, like D-Day, mm-hmm. the taking of the machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
All this stuff, but it's amazing how I forget how beautifully subtle the movie is, or the shows are individually. Like just like how Sobel is a jerk about everything, and he's trying to assert his authority by being in, but like no one respects him. They only fear him, and they just they can't wait to kill him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's things like the subtle differences between him and Winters as Winters is becoming a true leader.
Mm-hmm.
Not just a skilled tactician, but like a true leader. He gets the leadership of men. and the other guy doesn't, and that's why ultimately he the non-commissioned officers would rather risk being killed for mutiny than go on into war with him, with Sobel as their leader.
I'd have that. Y'all shot. Shot.
I wasn't expecting that. Well done, Luke.
Thank you. I'm pretty proud of that one.
Yeah. Ought to have y'all shot.
Ought to have y'all shot.
Yeah. But and then when I think it was particularly powerful when they're in Holland doing Operation Market Garden or Garden Market.
Yeah.
But the scene where they're grabbing the women and cutting their hair and they're bleeding and all this stuff.
The ones who slept with Nazis.
These things are they're weighty, you know.
Yeah. And your heart kind of goes out to them because, I mean, to try to be, you know, empathetic to a certain extent, what are they going to do?
Yeah.
You know, if your husband's dead, your husband's off at war, you don't have any money, your country's been taken over, you have a kid. I'm not trying to be like hooray for prostitution. I'm saying it's like, yeah. And then that, like, the anger that people feel who didn't do that, who resisted, who risked, you know,
the women who would rather starve than betray their people. And they see this, you know. Yeah. So it's just such a crazy, complicated thing. But to kind of like go through that, because Kateri has read a whole bunch of World War II books, these like historical fiction books. And they take place, it's really interesting, when we were really big in Latvia, she was reading a book about Lithuania and what the Germans did. And you kind of like, because we're so obviously and rightfully American-centric, we don't, like, the extent of what Germany did in, like, Lithuania, just banning the Lithuanian language in Lithuania and killing people if they had a book that was in Lithuanian, like, we don't even know that. Like, they didn't do that to Britain because they never got there, right? Like, it's just wild. It's a wild thing to realize, like, all the human wrecking ball that was the Third Reich.
Yeah. It's there's a reason why we're obsessed with it.
Yeah,
you know,
it, like, is it just, so fascinating. Absolutely.
Think about how many books have been written about Hitler and how many more will be written just to try to understand, like, how could someone do this? How could people go along with this? And then just the machine of that war, like just the destruction, you know, of 60 million lives in Europe alone is incomprehensible. 60 million lives, you know, and you go to certain parts of Europe, this is 20 years ago. Some of this is a little bit touristy. Some of it's not. The machine guns, the big, huge guns that are still in the hills of parts of Normandy and parts of Europe where they still have a building that's blown out that they just maintain this wall as a memory, or the towns where it's like, here's a modern building and here's a bunch of old stuff. And it's like, well, there's a reason why it's all not old. Yep. You know, it was all blown to hell. You think about that and, you know, like, there's this map. It was really, really fascinating of all the monasteries in England before Henry the Eighth. Yeah, screw you, England, and your tea. Go USA. Anyways, okay, so
don't try,
like,
on me.
They're everywhere. I mean, there's like, I mean, hundreds of them in a country the size of Connecticut.
Yeah,
and it's like a generation gone. And just how much is wiped out, and what remains of Europe, how much of a shell it is of what it once was, and what that war did, and you know what the first war did. There are people who still to this day have jobs, which is to find, particularly in places like Belgium, bombs that could kill people if they step on them.
Yeah,
you know, we're 80 years out. And we're 100 plus years out from the First World War, and there's still a danger there. And it's captivating is the wrong word, but there's a reason why it holds our attention.
Yeah, no, captivating, I think, is the right word, right?
It almost doesn't feel like enough. Yeah, right. You know, like,
yeah. I have a book that I'm clearing out a bunch of stuff in my office, and my office looks terrible, but We've got these books. Yeah. We got these bookshelves downstairs, and so I've been emptying some of my bookshelves and taking them down there. And
so long stuff of that's not about roofing.
Hello, roofing. Yeah. But a book that I kind of hid from myself for 20 years, I found.
Can I guess?
Yeah.
Did you get it at Auschwitz? Mm-hmm. Is it the big black book that's got like a lot of like the images and stuff?
No, it's...
I've got one.
Yeah, I have that. I have that. I also have one of the Stations of the Cross seen through a Polish concentration camp's
eyes. Yeah.
So that was crazy.
That's the one that... So you weren't on this episode when I had... D'Ambrosio on to talk about his film about St. Colby. That's a guy that he was talking about who did all that work. Yeah. I've got a book from Auschwitz that I have actually turned around.
Yeah.
On my bookshelf in my living room, just because I don't want like Auschwitz, you know, like I it sounds weird. I'm not trying to hide it. I think it's a little bit too macabre, but it's like, where do I put it? I don't want to like hide it in a closet. I want to remember that I have it. I want to, you know, make sure that I'm.
Yeah. So, my book was Dr. Joseph Mengele's assistant.
Oh, yeah.
And I read it on the train ride back or the bus ride back, and I finished it.
Yeah.
And I just had stack of like five books that I bought in Auschwitz or in Poland in general. And I remember, you know, my connection with Auschwitz is Auschwitz 1 used to be a German or a Polish military barracks that they turned into the prison. And that's the one that it will, whichever camp, they did that to a bunch of them, turned them into camps because they already had walls and stuff. But that's where Maximilian Kolbe was imprisoned and all this stuff, in one of those Polish army barracks that became a camp and then, you know, other stuff. And I went to the cell where he was put with like 10 other guys in a cell made for like two people and just horrific stuff. But my priests that raised me in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma were in a similar thing. So they were Polish Capuchin Franciscans. They had the Nazi number tattooed on their arm and they were liberated by troops from Oklahoma. And so they came to Oklahoma as missionaries in the 1950s. It took them 5 years to raise the money for the overseas voyage. And they were true Franciscans. They just begged their way from wherever they came in. I want to say they came in from Galveston Island and got to Kiefer, Oklahoma, and then eventually made their way to Broken Arrow. And then, of course, the Ku Klux Klan greets them by burning a cross in front of the church. But
welcome to America.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. Like, hey, I escaped the Nazis. Or did Lord I? Mercy. But the reality of what they went through, like he would tell a story, and it's just so shocking. But for me to go there, it was like, and I heard these stories since I was in, I don't know, maybe fifth grade or whatever, sixth grade. These were so real to me. And then to go and stand in front of one of the places and to see the sign that says, like, the first people that Hitler had arrested en masse were, that they were political prisoners who were here, such as anti-Nazi fighters, Catholic priests. And you're like, wait, what? And so it's like all these like political military people and then Catholic priests. And it said Catholic priests were arrested en masse because Polish was so intensely Catholic that individual men could become significant rallying points for the Polish people. And the fact that they were targeted and the stuff that they used to do to Polish priests, you know, these guys had to watch like their men chained to chain link fences and mutilated by dogs and stuff like that. Like they were used as like practice dummies for dogs to take down people and just, you know, suffer these horrible, you know, and life-ending wounds, bled out slowly. So seeing all this stuff, it's like watching Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, right? Like, or even for me, like in a certain sense, praying the Sorrowful Mysteries of the Rosary or doing the Stations of the Cross, there's so much gravity there that I like avoid it until those times when I know it'll be most important for me to see it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so Band of Brothers is like that for me, not because like it's not just another war movie for me, right? It's not like even Black Hawk Down is edging towards a territory because this was real people. It was a real failure. It was like, I mean, it's just horrific what they did, but like when they're, So when I'm in the Band of Brothers mood, half a decade has gone by and I'm like, I need to meet Sergeant Bull again.
Yeah. And
you know, and like I need winners and I need this stuff. It's funny.
Joe but, Torre in my life.
Yeah. Joe Torre. I love those guys so much. But yeah, so watching this with my daughter, I'm like, this is cool. This is cool.
Nice. I can't wait for that with Everly. She might be a little bit too young.
No, but, she's fine. She'll get it.
Yeah. I can tell you on one thing, he ain't Catholic. So it's interesting.
Prick's the son of Abraham. Oh, crap. I'm Jewish. Congratulations.
Hey, guys. What's up? This is Luke. I apologize for the bad audio. I am doing this on my headphones because my mic is broken. Yay. Okay. But I'm here, one, to get paid. But then two, actually, this is more important to me, to talk about these Steubenville conferences. If you've been listening to this podcast at all for any long period of time, which is all of you, you know how important these conferences are to me. What they have on the episode with my mom, talked about how she met my dad at a Steubenville conference. You've heard me talk about how it played a huge role in my conversion. Gomer obviously speaks at them. And okay, so the Steubenville conferences are where teens go to experience a life-changing encounter with Jesus Christ. There are 3 days of amazing speakers and opportunities for powerful worship, adoration, and confession with hundreds of other teens. And they're honestly some of the best youth conferences in the country, in my opinion. I love them. I think they're great. They're very important. And I really, if you have some teenagers in your life, I encourage you to get them to one of these conferences. There are dates throughout the summer and locations across the country. These conferences have been running for decades, and tens of thousands of Catholics across the United States will tell you their life completely changed when they first encountered Christ at a Steubenville conference. I am one of those people. There's a direct link from the Steubenville conferences in, you know, June of 1997. Actually, I think I went in July to this show right now, to me being here. And all the following conferences after that, I genuinely cannot imagine my life without the Steubenville conferences. And not just like the role they've had, but like how I encountered the Lord there, how I encountered others, and through encountering others, I encountered the Lord. Listen, if you're on the fence about this, go. They're great. They're really great. Gomer's going to be speaking at them. Obviously, click the link to learn more about them. All conferences are open through registration right now. So this is your sign. If you have been waiting for one, if you're in high school, one, why are you listening? But two, go to your parents and say, hey, do something. Have me go to this conference. If you've got teens, take them to this. They are wonderful. So again, all of these Steubenville conferences are happening across the country. They're now open for registration, and Catching Foxes heartily, with all the enthusiasm you can muster, a Luke at his peak in Austria in 2003 type of enthusiasm, encourages you to go to the Steubenville conferences. Thank you for the Steubenville conferences. Can't believe that these words are coming out of my mouth, for sponsoring this episode of Catching Foxes. Also, props to me for keeping that clean. You know, I'm pretty proud of myself. You should all be happy with that.
The favorite part is the two guys playing cards, and they hear them fighting. They hear the two guys
fighting.
Oh,
yeah.
And he goes, what are they fighting over? And he goes, he called Sobel a Jew. Turns out so-and-so is a Jew. So now they're fighting. And he goes, makes sense. Fighting over Sobel.
Idiots. You're like, yep. Yeah, there's something about, like, I don't know, man. You know, it's kind of this, you know what it reminds me of a bit? This is really sick. You know, we had the guys from the Total Ump Soccer show on like maybe 2 years ago now. And actually like a year and a half ago. And one thing I didn't tell them is like, sometimes I still go back and I listen to your episode about that happened. They recorded right after the U.S. did it to make the World Cup. Because it was just like, I just need to grapple with the unfathomable. But yeah. in like a light way, there's something about that is like really just intense and weird. And it's almost like that, you know? So I have a book that I'm reading. I wanted to bring up.
Okay.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have anything?
I have a page and a half of notes for tonight, but no, please.
Wait, no. Do you actually have a page and a half of notes?
I do. But it's okay.
I feel bad.
No, I want to go off your thing.
Is it what are your page and a half of notes on?
Nope.
Tell me.
No, because I'm not done yet. I'm still thinking through it.
Okay.
I was debating the whole time if like I'm trying to simplify it so that it's complex.
I'm gonna tell you okay. I had a funny thing happen today that was weird and awkward, but it was really funny.
Okay.
So, one of the reasons why I shaved my head was I wanted to do it while Everly could see it. You know, I didn't want to like surprise her with it because I don't want her to be like, wait, who are you? You know, and that's just kids who like freak out on their dad, shaves their beard or something. You know, it's always like,
yeah, it's happened to me. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I was like, hey, do you want to come with daddy while he like shaves it? And she goes, okay. And she like thought it was a blast. And so I didn't have my shirt on. And so, because I was, getting hair everywhere, and she had the broom and dustpan, she was going to like sweep everything up, and I would stop every couple minutes and be like, okay, so tell me what you think. And she goes, you look really good. And one time she goes, you look gorgeous.
Oh.
And I was like, thank you, baby girl. And so then I was taking her over to like, we were doing bedtime. I still didn't like have my shirt on. I have like hair everywhere, and stuff. And like, she like goes and she like sees my nipples and laughs and like holds up her hands and just twists them both. And I was like, that's weird. So yeah, that's what's having a 3-year-old is like, everyone. And then she kicked me in the nuts. That didn't happen in order. She kicked me in the nuts earlier, but that did happen today. She wanted to flip around. She just like jumps up while I was like holding her and kicks off. And I was like, good gosh, you can't do that.
I remember one time I was reading a book to the kids. I used to read to them all the time. And Thomas would like snuggle in. And as he was like laying on me, he pulled my shirt really tight so you could see my nipple. Not like you could see it, but through the shirt. And he would
It's cold outside.
He'd just go bloop, bloop, bloop. And I'm like, what the?
This kids is are so weird. I mean, so many moments were just like, this is odd.
Yeah.
Okay. So I got this book. I probably got it. I don't know what inspired me to get it. When it was in college, we took this class called French Revolution. We all called it French Rev. And I think it was like a
French history. Rev in 19th century Europe. It was awesome.
Then I had one on, it was a medieval history course. And so he would talk a lot about a historian named Christopher Dawson, who is Catholic. So I got one of Christopher Dawson's books. It's actually a collection of his speeches from the 20s. I want to say it maybe be earlier. I forget, but it is called Religion and the Rise of Western Culture. And so he's going into like the Dark Ages. So you basically have the sack of Rome by the Visigoths. And he's going into, I believe that's who did it. And he's going into the, like, basically what is the, what happens in Europe during the 5th and the 6th century. It's been a while since I have studied this time period.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the term the Dark Ages because it's like an
enlightenment. It's a loaded crap.
Yeah. It's like, but it's definitely like, it's a fascinating period. I'm going to set the scene here a bit and feel free to like pipe in, but try to imagine like, Rome as an empire covered everything, right? And then it's just gone. It just is gone. And what happens is you have like the collapse of a society, like not just of a culture, but like a total society. It's just like gone. Like all of the structures, the political, like all the stuff is just insane. And it becomes an extremely violent time. And even the barbarians that converted over to Christianity are like barely Christian. They're doing like horrifically violent acts. And for like a couple, like a good 100 years plus, it's a terrifying time. And the church was really what kept it all, like kept anything together from just like falling into like complete anarchy. Because what happens is, and I'm sure there are people who are way more intelligent about this than I would be, like, you are wrong here. But from what I understand, when the barbarians sack Rome, they don't take over the Roman government. Everyone is like left to themselves. And so these barbaric tribes, some are Christian, some are like in between there. And there's not a lot of political structure. So the church is actually like kind of holding culture to like together. And because it was like people's like sanctuary, it was like, I don't know if like sanctuary is even the right word, but it was the one thing you had to give you an identity almost that wasn't completely unstable, because from a political standpoint, it's just total upheaval. And so the church, and it's not, and It's just like the churches were like kind of builds everything out. But what tends to like get lost is just how horrifically like violent and how scary and how it felt like to everyone the world was. I mean, they thought the world was ending because of just how violent things were. And some people were still trying, not trying to like act like it was still unreal, but they were, you know, it was particularly a lot of your people who were in different parts of leadership in the church who had, they were educated. They were aware of like, of basically a more like a civilized way to live. And people are trying to cling to that, but most have no frame of reference for it anymore. So they're almost starting, not like from scratch, but it's a mess. It's an absolute mess, and it's a horrific mess, and it's a violent mess. And there is this line that really hit me well about some stuff. So I'm going to go into this. I'll do my best to try to, and well, you'll, I think you'll get why I wanted to bring this up. But it's kind of funny because it kind of like fits with what we were. Talking about with the Second World War and Europe. So this is Dawson here. Again, it's during a speech that he is giving. But though the religion of that day, of that age, he's speaking of Catholicism, was intensely otherworldly, its otherworldliness had a very different character from much that we have come to like associate with the word in its modern pious form. It was collective rather than individualist. It was objective rather than subjective. Realist rather than idealist. Although the world to come lay outside history and beyond time, it was a fixed limit towards which time and history were carrying the world. The ocean of eternity surrounded the seeking island of like human existence on every side. In the past, the world of men had been confident and secure. And this is the line here that like really hit me. As the waters of the sea retreated, they had pushed the limit of culture like further and like further under the protection of the dikes they had built. But now the waters were advancing, the dikes were down, and I was assumed there would be like no more land. Only the church remained as an ark of refuge, and it was a better investment to spend one's time and money on the building of an ark than to waste it in like a vain attempts to mend the broken dikes or reclaim the ruin of the ruined fields and assaulting. I love that idea of like, as the waters of the sea retreated, they had pushed the limit of culture further and further. My speech is terrible right now. I apologize. Under the protection of the dikes they had built, but now the waters were advancing. The dikes were down, and I'm going to assume there would be like no more land. Only the church remained as an ark of refuge. And it was a better investment to spend one's time and money on the building of an ark than to waste it in vain attempts to mend the broken dams. Sorry, to mend the broken dikes. Isn't that fascinating?
I do. Yeah.
Like that idea of like culture was able to like protect them. It was like it was so funny because I'm going to build this once again as we do on the backs of Catholic stuff. You should know right before we recorded, I saw this episode and it had Christopher Dawson in the title, and I was like, damn it. And they were talking about Father John spoke of culture as a shared way of life. I was like, I like that way to like. I like that idea. I like that definition of culture. When I think about right now, I think about everything we have like been through as a society in the last 200 years. The world's a pretty violent place, and I think there's this temptation to want to like like reinforce the dikes. And this idea of the church as being like refuge, and it's from the church, and it's not about trying to protect so that we can maintain. It's about trying to come together so that we can live and then go out from there.
Yeah.
And you know what sucks is we're not going to get the old Europe back. It was blown to hell. And there are things that we can maintain just like they maintain from Roman culture that we still have to this day, right? Different forms of government and ideas and other things like that. But this, how there was a period in history, it almost seems to like repeat itself, oddly enough, where just everything goes to hell. And it's like, what do you do? And when I say that everything is going to hell, I'm not really talking about all of the changes in culture of the past 20 years. I'm talking about the past 200 years.
Yeah.
That where, you know, when I take a look at my life right now, I've never once thought of, I mean, it's been tempting to leave the church is the right word, but it's an odd way to reinforce, like, no, I really believe this.
Yeah.
I really, really do, because this is reality. And where else would I go? Where else would I go? And it's almost why I had to get a job at a non-church institution, just because I needed to like maintain my sanity, because where else am I going to go? Mm. You know? And I feel almost this weird freedom to like enter deeply into the life of the church now in an odd way, because I don't like... I'm no longer trying to, as much as I said I wasn't or I didn't care about Christendom, like I care about Christian culture. I care about culture deeply. I care about shared living. I think it's really important and very, very necessary. And to not like live a life of that is to not dwell in reality. But the only way to do that is to like let the dikes break, to let it all like to like go into the church, let it be the ark, let it, you know, be the refuge and try to ride those waters. There's nothing else that I can do. And the future, it's weird and it's scary. And to me, it's not the typical culture war stuff that scares me. It's, you know, we have a president election coming up. It's going to be a joke. Sorry, a presidential election where one person who could win will be 86 when he's done. If you know, he gets it. And the world is in a perilous spot right now. And what terrifies me is we haven't had a good global conflict in 80 years. And like, you're kind of overdue for one. Looks like we were overdue for a pandemic. I don't want someone like Joe Biden in there, but I don't want a person like Trump either. Cause I think Trump, to me, without getting typical here, is the epitome of trying to like reinforce the dikes. And I don't know what else to do besides just return to the ark and like go from there. You know, like I went to an Oscar party over at Kevin Heider's, and it was wonderful. It was great to be around. I love the Oscars. They're so stupid and pointless and extremely, extremely like narcissistic and incredibly shallow. The half the show is just, aren't movies great? Aren't we so important? And it's like, not in the slightest, but I love this. But, you know, I'm just Ken, so here I am. And
I'm just Ken.
But there was, I'm going on like a bit of like a rant here, and I'll stop. But there was something about doing that. Like, I didn't want to do that alone. It's dumb to do it alone. It's pointless. But then with other people, it becomes this magical experience where we're able to talk about like movies and why a film to me like Oppenheimer matters. And I almost got like a huge argument about that. And why I think Barbie matters. And why I got into almost a screaming shout with my good buddy Joe about how he hated Taylor Swift's like Folklore. And I was like, Joe, I'm going to fight you. And I just was like, man, like, how do you rebuild after the Second World War? You know, there were practical things that had to be done, but how do you rebuild that shared way of life?
Yeah.
I don't think we have. We've put a Band-Aid on it and it's called soccer. You know, that's all I got now. That's it. I mean, you even hear soccer pundits talk about like the like collapse, like religion, and how soccer has replaced it. And it's like, well, that's not going to last. That's not gonna, you know. And so like, what do you, you know, man, like, what are we doing here? We're like, it's like we're lying to ourselves that we died.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, God is dead and we have killed him and we don't want to admit the consequences of this.
Yeah.
That was the whole point of Thus Spake Zarathustra, is like, look, we have blood on our hands. All of modernity has blood on its hands, and the blood is the blood of gods. And people keep thinking, no. Look, like the Sam Harris's of the world. No one irritates me more in a way. Like, I used to like him a lot as part of the Four Horsemen of the new atheism. I used to like him a lot. Brilliant, you know, scientist and all this stuff. And I enjoyed his jabs against Christianity individually and religion as a whole, as a obviously devout Christian. But you see the madness of someone like him in his anti-Trump hysteria. One of the things that he said publicly on a podcast that I watched the beginning and end of, he said, you know, I don't care if Hunter Biden laptop covers up like murder, like killing people. It should be suppressed. All of the press should be in collusion to make sure Donald Trump cannot be reelected. I'm not using like trying to Trump bandwagon here, but
yeah.
The whole point being, he said, Trump is an existential crisis to democracy. But the thing that was killing me was, as he advocates for the existential destruction of democracy in order to save democracy.
Exactly.
Right? This is the catch 22.
It's just two sides of
hey, you know the what we should coin. Do? We should get the institution that's supposed to hold our political leaders accountable, the press, who has been essentially Pravda without calling it Pravda, has been in hook, line, and sinker with the federal government for years, because turns out the DC press and the DC politicians all drink the same dry martinis in the same bars and fornicate with one another and all this stuff.
Great bars, so, though.
The great bars. I mean, they don't great go bars. To dive bars.
No.
It's like $15 for a martini. It's fine. But these people, like, to advocate the destruction of the other, because he's going to destroy democracy, and by the only way you can do that is by destroying democracy, maybe you're asking the wrong question, right? Exactly, maybe exactly. Biden versus Trump is not the thing. Maybe we need to back it up and look wider. And so part of the thing that I have all of these notes on, and I still don't have it like framed correctly in my head, next month at the end of May for my birthday, I haven't bought the tickets yet, but I want to go to Steubenville to the New Polity conference that they're doing, because they're interviewing one of my favorite authors, Matthew Crawford. Shop Classes, Soulcraft, The World Beyond Your Head.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I had mentioned this to you about a month ago, but...
You did? I don't remember that. Sorry.
Yeah. No, it's fine. But like, it's great. I've healed.
I'm sorry. I don't remember that at all.
I've healed. Look, I'm healed. This is me being healed.
Sorry.
No, so
I'm excited. We had a fight where we dragged it out and then we argued on Twitter.
Yeah. I think we're going to get about three or four guys, including my parish priest here. But one of the things you talked about that I meant to write down, I didn't write it down, but he said, you know, during our Christmas party, he gave a speech, and it was, you know, one of the common refrains you hear from the world is, when you don't like something, turn to activism, get politically activated, you know, go do this stuff. And he said, that's entirely the wrong thing to do. He's like, there's a time and a place for things like that. But the right thing to do is go home, start small, and build the society you want to see. And he said, and chances are, if you do that, if you build that kind of culture that you want to see, chances are other people, even people on the politically like opposite side of you, also want that similar culture, right? Like they want that. Like, I think of like watching this vegan and this carnivore debate each other, you know, and usually it's about whether you're victimizing animals and stuff. But it almost always is, but what about the environmental impact of these processes? Because you can't feed the world veganism without massive corporate industrial things. And the approach is like, you don't understand, you're destroying the environment by wanting to do this. And it's like, yeah, but you don't understand, you're destroying the environment with cow farts and methane and all this stuff. And it's like, it's so funny, because when they kind of give you their ideal world, it tends to be a lot closer. Like the world, like, you know, when I watch a lot of like these farming videos, I'm watching homesteaders in Portland that are probably the most far out liberal people, progressive people on the face of the earth. But they're, you know, doing regenerative farming and agriculture and stuff, like all these like hardcore right wingers in Texas are trying to figure out how to do that on their compound ranch, you know, like, and that's the thing is like, if you actually reduce the noise, the signal to noise ratio, I guarantee you we have a lot more in common, but we're so bent out on activism and activism as really about feeling the right feelings, not even about doing anything. And to a certain extent, saying the right things that on either side, that like we just keep perpetuating the problem. Like it's a massive flywheel. The flywheel is spinning so fast. It's scary.
And it's, you know, one thing that's really interesting about this book is like, he talked a bit about how, I thought this was like really fascinating. Like if you look at like early church, you have the church fathers during, it's a little bit later. I cannot believe I'm drawing a blank on this term, but if you look at like Renaissance time period, not the Dark Ages, the medieval period,
the medieval period.
Yeah. Like he's going into like basically like the height of,
yeah, the high Christendom, middle ages.
Heavy. Yeah, say, yeah, the middle ages. I was like, why can't I think of this term?
Oh, okay.
Sorry. I was like, what the hell, Luke?
Yeah, the high middle ages around the 1100s, the 1300s.
Yeah. That was really weird. You have like a lot of like mystics. And during this time period, people are clinging to the saints because the saints were like a refuge. Because again, like it's an incredibly violent time. Like you're seeing people take, like they were talking about how you're seeing people that like you love being kidnapped, being tied to a rope, and then almost sold as being carried off into bondage. Like it's just, it's, you know, insanity. It's incredibly, I'm all the violent, everyone's being killed. Like it's just, you know, it's truly horrific. And that, like, this is where you get like the cult of the saints. This is when things such as like relics become very big. And it's almost like these were very pagan things that they clung to because there was a Christian element to them. And it's not necessarily that they then Christianized the pagan as much as they like clung to things that were true and allowed them to grow. And probably to a point of where it became a little bit weird, but like they truly were. It's like saint obsessed because that's where they could like experience like miracles, where they could like actually find safety at a place where like a saint was being honored at like a church to go and hide, or, you know, like other things like that. And so it really did make you think, like, what are we turning to? And we're constantly turning to what are just like modern answers, which is just, what is your strategy? What is your plan? Which is all not bad things in and of themselves, but it's like, that's the problem. We're here because we thought we could think our way out of our problems. So the last fucking thing we should do is think our way out of our problems. I don't mean you don't think, right? I just mean you don't view that as a one way to get out of the problem. That's why we're here.
Listen, what will solve the division of the Protestant Reformation and Catholicism and decadent Catholicism in the 1500s is philosophy. If only we could turn to pure reason and elevate reason alone, then philosophy... Oh, wait. Philosophy divided us permanently more than the division of Christianity. Okay. All we need is new forms of political regimes coming from the various philosophical systems.
Exactly.
Then we, oh crap, that led to,
like, I'll show you the power of the mind, right? You know, like that, that one scene from Barton Fink that I'm repeating myself, and I promise I'm never going to do that again, but I'm going to, cause it's so important to this thing. Have you seen Barton Fink? It's an early-ish Coen brothers film. It's phenomenal. Yeah. And long story short, it's about this one Hollywood like writer who just is going insane or something. And he's in this hotel and it's like burning down. He's in hell, and John Goodman is, I forget what he's doing, what his character is, but he basically, he's got a gun. He goes, I'll show you the power of the mind. I will show you the like power, of the mind. Heil Hitler. And like, he like either kills himself or he like kills someone, but it's like, that's what reason led to, right?
That's interesting that he says that while the hotel is burning as a sign of hell.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's this incredible line from the Genesis talks from Jordan Peterson where he's staring at the ground and he goes, I don't know. Maybe it's true. Maybe Catholicism is true, that the height of satanic power is pure reason, that that is the Luciferian lie, that reason detached from everything else is the most satanic thing. And you're like, wow, okay.
And that's like one reason why like people during the Dark Ages clung to the saints, because there was no reason. There was only safety.
All was lost.
There was only safety. Yeah. You know, and sometimes like that idea of a safety could turn almost in, like into, you would almost have like a soothsayer type of thing, which is where it gets a little bit weird. But yeah. You also had this Christian idea of hope he talks constantly about the eternal and the temporal being met, particularly at Mass and like at the liturgy, that like where like all, you know, all of culture comes. And I think it's important when we talk about these things, particularly with, you know, in the liturgy. So get very excited here, Gomer. We're not talking the bells and the whistles, but the season of Christmas, the season of Lent, Easter.
Yeah.
The church is like this time period of entering in together into these deeper, profound mysteries and what that does. And eventually what rebuilds the dikes, what pushes like the water out, what prevents you from being drowned, is true culture. It's, you know, that's why like going to a dumb Oscar party for me was so life-giving. And like, I'm going through, you know, as everyone knows, like I'm divorced. I'm working on the annulment right now, and it's scary and it's weird. And there are times I'm like, do I even want this? I don't know. Like, what am I doing? You know, and it's a hard thing to try to think through and to try to navigate. And it's like, I don't know what else to do, but cling to this thing. Cause nothing else makes only the church and John Mulaney's joke about the Field of Dreams stuff makes sense.
What's that?
Did you see that? Oh gosh, Gomez is wonderful. He goes on the Oscars and he goes, sound is important to films, with like, you know, people will say that like this. I don't remember. So he basically goes into how like anyone who says that, if you go back to the silent era film as the height of film, is dumb, because without sound you won't get great lines like we're going to need a bigger boat. He says this other line and he goes, and it was, he died while researching spiders with my mom in the Amazon. Like, you know, he quotes a thing from like Madame Web, from everyone.
Yeah. From Madame Web. Yeah, I did.
And then he just goes through and goes, or if you build it, they will come. Kevin Costner tore down. And then he like go through the entire plot of Field of Dreams, like the entire, for like a minute, the entire plot. And at like one point in time, he references the book that James Earl, that the character James Earl Jones was supposed to like have written, goes, which was a book that I thought was real deep into my 20s. And like, it was just really funny. But like, my point is like, that is that like shared experience, that shared way of life. When you are doing that with other people, and when you are rooted in the church in reality, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it's incredibly, incredibly hopeful. And I wonder if our kind of thing that like we need right now, you know, he talks about, Dawson said in the beginning there, that their experience of church was extremely different than ours. It was not this individualistic. And he's talking way before the idea of Vatican II is even out there, right? It's, you know, this is 1920. I want to say it may have even been during the teens. He's talking like, it might be that we need shared life, which I know we've like pounded to death on this the show, and we'll continue to do so, because everything's hyper individualistic now. And it's just like, I don't know what else to do besides enjoy the things that I enjoy with others. And I'm sorry. That's weird. I'm tired. So I hope this makes sense.
Well, so let me just,
that's a way of saying nope.
No, I want to tie it to what I was thinking about. Like, one of the funny things with the roofing company that keeps coming up is this notion of, to build something I could hand on to my children, whether or not I do, right? That's not the point. And ministry today, in a certain sense, is a lot like software engineering. And this kind of has been taught to me, doing services that don't involve any physical goods, right? Do you remember Zygmunt Bauman, the Austrian sociologist, Liquid Society, Liquid Modernity? He talks about how software is eating the world, and it creates this experience of everything is liquid, therefore nothing matters. And like religion was one of 8-10 different things he was talking about that provided solidity to life. And now that we got rid of religion, you know, that now we have entertainment, health, politics, you know, and all of which are viewed through a lens of radical individualism, like me, my self-actualization, how it makes me feel, my self-care, my this, my that. And so everything has to have, like, work can't just be work. It has to be following my bliss. It has to be deeply meaningful. It has to be all these things. And so what I realized in the roofing company is I'm not devoted to roofs, obsessed about roofs, find my bliss on a rooftop with asphalt shingles. What instead happened is I'm fascinated by a durable trade that has existed for thousands of years. People always need roofs. Roof technology changes, but that AI is not going to replace, because this is why private equity firms are trying to buy roofing and HVAC contractors like crazy, is because they realize it's a hedge against AI. Isn't that wild?
You talked about this last week.
Right. So I'm stacking the evidence.
No, it's fine. Yeah, no. You're fine.
But all of these things, when they stack, you realize, like, I now deeply care about asphalt shingles and metal roofs and HVACs. I care about this stuff because I see not only its impact in people's lives, but I want there to be something that lasts.
That's so cool.
That then becomes another solid thing in my family's life. Like, for them to drive by and say, my dad did that, my dad helped with that, my dad sold that, my dad, you know, built that. Like, for someone like me who has no skills and was never trained in handyman skills, has nothing like that, and all the groping after them is like this sad, pathetic thing that I do with like woodworking and stuff, that I've realized it's some sort of ache for permanence or something rock solid in a liquid world.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, all these high school students that I do ministry with who barely have faith, parents never go to church, they never go to church. And the only reason why they come into my orbit is because they're forced to go to some confirmation retreat. And when I talk with them, I don't see great rebellion. I don't see great anger or hostility. I see their whole lives as boredom alleviated by distraction.
Yeah.
Like, they're the most boring kids on the face of the earth, even like, because all of their life is dictated by like these massive corporations that feed them entertainment. And they're, because their entertainment is so radically individualized, they're consuming it like way more than I consume YouTube, which is still shocking.
It's wild.
Like, it's a shocking amount. Yeah. I'm not gonna lie, it's a shocking amount.
You know what's really interesting? We both are like kind of going through this weird thing right now that's very much the same, where we're kind of branching out beyond church work in our our professional lives, but we're also both like, I have found myself increasingly, this has been happening for like a while, but just starting to think more deeply about art and film. Like, I had thoughts about Pocahontas today, like a lot of thoughts about why it failed as a film, what are some of the good parts, all this like why these, some of the songs are just fantastic and others aren't, and I was like, why am I doing this? And I was like, because it flipping matters, like the stuff, and like and understanding this stuff and trying to find the good, it really matters. And what you're talking about with like the with like, you know, that roof and wanting to pass things on, something that have a sense that has a sense, that has a sense of like permanence, that has a thing that can exist outside of yourself, that really matters.
Yeah.
That really, yeah. There was a guy really who was a,
he was making multiple, it was a 6-figure salary. He left it to go, I don't know if it was roofing, I can't remember, but this is something from like 4 or 5 years ago. And he wrote a book called, I think it's called Durable Trades. And the whole point is like, what are businesses that existed at the start of the, you know, of a, the American Revolution? Like what existed then? Does it still exist now?
Pubs.
Let's do those things. Yes. Right. And so things like building roofs and metalwork and bar like keeps. He's just talking, huh?
Bar keeps.
Sure. Sure. No, but he was like, talking about like the trades. Country
going with bars, my friend.
Yeah. But I'm so talking about trades. I'm talking about things that involve like high levels of skill that,
yeah.
that can
yeah.
be communicated, that are communicated through culture. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's mm-hmm. the point of the world beyond your head was you can't be a rebel until you know what you're rebelling against. That's my whole point about the like weird boredom of today's children is they're not really rebelling. And when they do rebel, it's almost like a show or something like that or a social media thing.
Well, I mean, you want to show how much you are like other people by rebelling because you are defining the world on your own terms. And that's what we are yeah. all supposed to be doing.
Yeah, look, I feel the same feels. Okay.
Yeah.
And so building something that lasts, that's beautiful, that endures, that's good, that's honest. One of the things with that is this is what I found fascinating. So there was someone who did a philosophy on Matthew Crawford's thing about like how did we end up with just such a bipolar society in America? And I read a book called The Conflict of Visions by Thomas Sowell. He's a famous economist, but he talks about how you tend to have two different visions: the Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau's vision of the natural man in his natural state, and society is that which corrupts him. And then you have the more Hobbesian Lockean vision, which is no man in his state of nature is red in tooth and claw; it's nasty, brutish, and short. We need the Leviathan. We need the government to take away part of our rights so that they can guarantee mm-hmm. more of our rights and all this stuff. And the fascinating thing, so this guy writes this piece, and it's a long piece. Let me see if I can find the title. It is What is Ideology? And it's called The Victimological Imagination. And he talks about, like, me and you talked about in an episode, it's something like either they kill us, oh gosh, or we... Either we die or we become the oh gosh.
The line from Batman, you either die.
No, it wasn't the line from Batman, but it was kind of, yeah. I mean, it was in that spirit.
It's either Batman or Jurassic Park on this show, so.
Yeah, it was one of those
two things, yeah.
Why do we fall, Mr. Wayne?
Learn to pick ourselves. That really moved me in 2005. I was like, that's right, I can't get over this breakup.
But so Rene Girard.
He could not.
Yeah. Plot twist. Rene Girard has this thing where, you know, scapegoating as a mechanism, right? He said in the pagan world, you have scapegoating where everyone in society basically gets together. They pick the person to be the victim, and that person is a scapegoat. And what you do is you transfer all the problems in society onto that person. Usually that person is an other in some identifiable way, right? The Jew in the midst of a Christian town, you know, the black person in the midst of a white town, you know, whatever it is. And someone is other for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. You pick them. They become the sacrificial victim, and you pour out your violence on that person, and thus you have cleansed your society. But what Christ did, so Rene Girard is a Catholic, he's brilliant, and what he did was he shows how Christ, by being the scapegoat, exposes the victimizers, the victimization mechanism, as it's called, right? Mm-hmm. And so in pre-Christian culture, violence happens because the community is about to tear itself apart. So you just pick a scapegoat, you tear them apart, and through that ritual sacrifice, society has some sort of restoration and sustained unity, right? But then with Christianity, the problem was the passion of Jesus and the Gospels reveal the mob dynamics, right? So the victim is actually innocent, and everyone involved acknowledges his innocence, but they still need to destroy him. It is better for one man, for an innocent man to suffer, innocent man to die, than the whole nation perish. Right. So they expose the victim dynamics of the mob. And by doing that, Christendom broke this victimological mindset. Right. You have the victim, the one that is offered, and it broke it. And it was what they call the first revolution, because everywhere else you pick someone to blame and you sacrifice them. Right. Right now there's a group of church people they just picked a person and they're just destroying him and all of his friends, publicly shaming him and attacking him. just to destroy him so that they can have a scapegoat. And you know what? I realize I totally was guilty of that. I've scapegoated people. Like, I take over a job, you scapegoat the people who were there behind you so that you come across as this epic hero, right? And the fascinating thing is when you disregard, when you go post-Christian, right? Post-Christian, Jesus inverted everything by saying, no, the victim is the innocent one, and the sympathy and all of that becomes a part of society. So now we have sympathy for innocent victims of violence, right? But now we've moved outside of Christianity. And so the crazy thing that's happened is this is a line from the book. The third great epoch of victim consciousness is our own, which begins with political philosophers offering theoretical legitimizations of the modern state that draw upon the moral force of victimhood by withdrawing it imaginatively from the context of Christian devotion and thus secularizing it. So what they did was, the first main guy of this is Niccolo Machiavelli in his The Prince, where he said, look, if you're going to be a prince and you're going to take over all the power in that government, this is what you need to do. You need to say to everyone, and you need to make it absolutely clear, you are against the great and you are for the people, and you are there to provide protection for the people against the great, and the great are the elites, the people who want to command and oppress, even if they're not really existing. You can do that. So the great he knows that he's always going to have trouble from the great people ruling, so he makes himself the people's protector. And when you listen to dictators, and when you listen to both sides of U.S. politics, they always voice that, right? I'm on the side of the people to protect you from the elites in D.C. I'm going to drain the swamp. I'm on the side of the working man to protect you from the corporate thugs and robber barons of our society, right? We always do this by saying you're the people's protector. Christianity made the human heart sympathetic with the victim. Paganism demonized the victim in order to scapegoat. So now what we did in flipping it, we detached it actually from virtue, from justice, from anything, and it becomes a claim to power. That's what Machiavelli did. He said, no, you stop thinking about victims in the sense of, you start thinking of victims as, I need to win them to my side so that I will stop them and prevent them from being victims, so they have to write a blank check for my power. And what Hobbes did was he said, yes, and all of, man, getting over this grossness. Hobbes basically said, all of humans are born into the state of nature, so we need to save ourselves from the invaders, not just elites of society, but the invaders. And so the people, as a body politic, are not afraid of the elite. They're of which the kings are happy about that transition. They're afraid of they're fearful of whatever invaders. And then the next step up was Locke, who basically said, "Listen, the reason why government has its ability to kill us is because every man in a state of nature has the right to defend himself. And so everyone has our consent that we can kill someone if they're coming after us." So then the shift becomes the notion of rights. And that these are the, this might have been like philosophy 101 and annoying, but people don't realize like these thoughts are at the very foundation of America first.
Yes.
And then it went back through France and through Germany and Italy, England.
Yeah, I'm not giving
a chronological order.
Here. I'm like Scotland. Yeah.
Right. I'm not. Yeah. Absolutely. But like the Scottish ideals of Adam Smith, who tried to found everything on sentimentalism. His view is a moral theory of sentiments. But all of these things, right? So you see this massive in the Edinburgh Enlightenment and
can I just add like one? Please, I think it's important to note that it's in America and Scotland particularly where this is all being lived out, like it is actually happening.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
It is happening here. It's not necessarily the fact that it's coming from here. It's that this is where these ideas are happening out in Western Europe, and they're being actually like almost, for lack of a better term, tested and lived.
Yeah,
like America is the big experiment almost in all of experiment. This.
Yeah. And it's fascinating. And you know, I mean, part of the reason why Alexis de Tocqueville in the 1830s came to the U.S. and wrote the famous book Democracy in America is because democracy kept being rebooted in France and it wouldn't stick, right? it kept failing. You had Napoleon, you had all this stuff. You had all, you know, the, we're on the Fifth Republic now. And yeah. So he wanted to come to America to be like, how did you make it work? And so he has all these like powerful observations and all this stuff. But the reality, so he's trying to, they're telling these stories of like, how do our governments legitimize their power? And so pre all of this, it was because they were virtuous. Virtue was the claim of the aristocracy. Mm-hmm. They are yep. virtuous people. Their whole lives are ordered to this one thing, right? So like the crown, and it's especially in season one and season two
yeah.
of the depiction of the tremendous sacrifices that Elizabeth II had to do to herself, her personality, all this stuff, to be molded to be a right and proper queen of England.
And that's right. Well, and I would add too, like yeah. it's through that that you are tasked with creating and preserving that shared way of life being culture.
Yes.
Like you are a patron of the arts, patreon.com/MCF. Like you have but my entire career is built upon this idea that, you know, the wealthy have an obligation
yeah.
to like to give. Because that's what creates culture, and that's what like creates not just, but like I mean, I'm culture in the truest sense, and that's what helps. Like anyway, so sorry.
Yeah, they're the patrons of the arts. That's what like there would be no art yeah, without them,
and that's what right? like creates an Aztec society where the vulnerable are protected.
Yeah. So and then so, you see this. Sorry.
Anyways,
the aristocracy preserves tradition. You see this with the election and the, yeah. the coronation of King Charles III, like. As he, you know, as they're doing all the stuff and the rites and in the middle of the liturgy that people don't understand and all these things, and it's like, oh, it's so weird, so different. And then he goes behind the screen to actually be coronated. The aristocracy preserves tradition, but we hate aristocracy in America. We always have, because mm-hmm. most of our country in its earliest time was the victims of aristocracy, right? Whether they're British aristocracy, German aristocracy, except right? People who South. Had power. And yeah. Yeah. And so the victims have come here en masse, and it was the regular yeah. people. And one of the reasons why they call America the exceptional nation is because we did not, except in a large part in the South, the New England area especially, did not really have an aristocratic thing. And that's Alexis de Tocqueville's whole point is when you go there, it's a mercantilist society, right? Capitalism, you know, mm-hmm. whatever.
Yeah.
It's a mercantilist society. Everything is built around layers between the state and the individual, and these mediating layers give identity, give value to life, and they give form and structure to life that doesn't really exist in Europe for the average man. And then on top of that, you have this super powerful idea of individualism, of what he calls homo solus. Every man is now just alone. So if you're alone and I'm alone and everyone's alone, we create systems and culture that supports the individual. Whereas in Europe, they were still like feudalism still weighed heavy, especially back then in Europe. Right. I mean, mm-hmm. like World War yeah. II or World War I, they were all cousins, right? The British, the German and the, yeah. and the Russian.
They're all related.
They grew up together as children.
Yeah.
You know? And so like the feudalism and the whole thing, the problem is when you have aristocracy, you are the ones who preserve tradition. You are called to bend your entire life to martial skills. So all of them are in the military. All the men are in the military. There's a warrior ethos that's a part of it, which is why when they encountered Native Americans, so many Europeans were in love with them because they were a natural aristocracy. All they did was eat and fight, right? Like it's and hunt. And that's like, yes, that's what we want to do for our lives. But there's this crazy sense that when Locke made that move, basically saying, okay, so we have sympathy for the victim, and then you got Machiavelli saying, no, that's how the elites, that's how the great one attains power, is by saying, I'm fighting on behalf of the victim. So now the victim isn't the scapegoat, the victim is the legitimizing force. And then Hobbes has the same thing, and then Locke has the same thing, but then Locke talks about death, and he said, and this is in the article, he said, and this feisty spiritedness of Lockean rights rhetoric is perfectly expressed in the Gazdin flag, right? The don't tread on me flag with
yeah.
the coiled snake.
Yeah.
And this is how he says, a rattlesnake coiled to strike in self-defense as a potential victim on high alert against its violation. The rights-bearing individual is irascible and testy. This undertone of reactive defensiveness is given virile face by a projected posture of readiness for retaliatory violence against an overarching government. So he's trying to show how, like, these
that's
conceptions of life,
yeah,
and of rights. Like, there was no such thing as rights in St. Thomas Aquinas. The word use, J-U-S, like rights, justice, they were not understood the same. Like, you have a right to this thing was not the same thing as inalienable rights. And what are those? Well, once justice stops being a virtue, right? Justice is a cardinal virtue wherein I have a disposition to always give others what is their due. That is not true anymore in our modern nation state. Justice is a political arrangement where individuals assert their rights against an ever-growing nation state. So it's a defense mechanism. And then that's in the 1700s. In the 1800s, rights were, well, it's not negative rights. You can't take away my free speech, my free press. Now it's, you owe me an education, you owe me healthcare, mm-hmm. right? So they're positive rights. And it's fascinating to see that the Lockeans become the neoconservatives. And then that kind of branches into two categories, which you got the libertarians and you got the MAGA Donald Trumpians, the patriots, right? You have these two things. And on the other side is Rousseau. And Rousseau comes in and he's like, okay, so if the state of nature of man is violence and we achieve peace by surrendering part of our rights to the government to keep us away from being violently assaulted, I don't believe that's true. I believe the state of nature of man is not violence, but peace. And the perfect equilibrium is tribal man. Not modern civilized man, that the savage is more noble. So that's what we call it, the myth of the noble savage. That's Rousseau's view. And Rousseau's view, he basically says, all right, all the things you're saying about the state to legitimize it, I'm saying is the very reason why all states are delegitimate. There's this whole world of claims of violence and all this stuff. No, the natural man is perfect. And it's our civilization that's ruined them. And the civilization itself is delegitimate. And so for us, he says, and I love this, he says, the victims is all of humanity. So therefore, our rage and our resistance and all of this has to be a revolutionary radicalism in protest against the system. And that you see growing ever more in the left. And then when you mix it with identity politics on the left and on the right, you see this growing and growing. And then you look and you ask yourself, how the hell did we get here? And you're like, well, this is how we got here. This is how we got here. We got here by chucking the church's conception of metaphysics and morality, and thus politics were permanently altered. Machiavelli said, you legitimize your reign by going after the victims and protecting them. Both sides do that. Right. You know, the Donald Trumpy or the patriots, whether Trump or Tea Party or whatever, they're the ones who are defending the rights of the ordinary working man. Right. And then you have the other libertarians who are defending the rights of companies and corporations and entrepreneurs. And then you have the left who are focusing on victims of systemic racism and poverty and classism. And then they push these identity politics ever further. They don't care if they actually achieve that post-racial harmony. They're legitimate by just caring about the victim. And so everyone is just locked in this primeval debate with our myths of fallen man and states of nature. And then we look at culture and it's like, we just have rival cultures. We have rival cultures.
And this is why I think that, like, we have, like, I think this is why I'm a little bit like, this is a lot to hold in your head at once.
Yeah. Which is why I took two pages of notes and I tried to break it down, but I didn't do a good
job. No, but you're getting at a thing that we've been talking about for a very long time, which is so going back to this whole thing about the dikes breaking and the land starting to shrink and the water overcoming us has been happening for 500 years. And this is the consequence of all of that. And this is why our strategy and all this stuff isn't going to work. I don't know what will work besides grace. I think you can absolutely combat these ideas with other ideas. And I think you should engage with that. And we should push back. And I'm actually even starting to change my tone of, or my thought about the idea that, like, politics is the result of culture as opposed to like politics forms culture. I've had some good conversations with my buddy like Nick about this a bit, and I'm starting to kind of change my tune on it slightly, but it's fascinating to me that if you take a look at what's really formed and shaped broad culture, it's either been like Rome or the church. Okay, Western culture. It has been Rome or the church. It has either been an empire, a massive political organization, or like this like massive religious organization. And we've kind of been going to the other way now. That didn't make any sense. It's almost like we've now pushed out the church, and that's all that's going to be able to replace that is the political. But it's not the same political. It's not the same politic as it was in the past, because it's not even a collective experience of that or a collective structure. It's almost one that is more a politic of ideals.
Yeah,
and individualistic experience that is continuing to get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. So the only way to combat that, the only way to really be in that arc, I'm not even saying to like, you know, like reinforce the dikes or try, I'm saying just to stay alive is to do the opposite of that, is to not be engrossed in an like world of ideals, because you're saying like those are the ideals I'm fighting with there. It's like, man, and I'm there's so much. I'm trying to say like a bit of a higher level right now than kind of going
keep
down
it
to
meta.
Like,
let's keep it at 50,000.
Well, no, because like there's a lot there about like what like Hobbes said and like what Unlocked did and the consequence of like, to a certain extent, like America is not the child of Rousseau. It's definitely the child of Locke. It's definitely to a certain extent there is some Hobbes there. You got to throw in Voltaire a bit. A lot of that comes through through Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and all of the founding fathers for good and for ill. And all of this influences the way that we view the world. So until we understand that, like, we actually have to try to understand stuff as opposed to like be in a place of ideals and like a lived reality of what a thing actually is.
Yeah.
We are never going to get out of this.
Yeah.
Like the only, that's why it has to start with grace, and why it's a, I understand why people are going to vote for Donald Trump. I don't agree with it, but I get it. And I think there is a thing to like be said about trying to bring some normality back to the world, you know, and that's okay. Like, fair point. If you think by voting for Donald Trump too, that, okay, I'm not going to hold that against you per se. I don't agree with it, but like, it's still just a Band-Aid. Like it's like a gaping wound. Right. And there's just and I don't know how you really try to go about this, and like, instead of being individualistic, be communal.
Yeah.
Right. And instead of trying to like fight the, like, you know, like, to me, Barbie is like a film that like starts in hell and ends in Eden. And, you know, she starts in a world where there is no water, there is no food, everything is fake. And she ends by going to her gynecologist. She ends by going to a place where like actually life can grow. You know, it's kind of almost the inverse of like the Genesis story. Not, I'm not saying that that's actually true, but like,
yeah,
if you're not thinking about, okay, to me, it's fine if you want to like, if you understand what she's trying to say and go, I just didn't like it, or I like reject the argument, fine. But if you're not, you're not helping. You're making all of this worse, right? And if you like, with like the stuff that like you're doing and saying, I want to bring out a thing that is permanent. If we go back, or if, like, I go to you and say, that's great, Gilmer, but like, you know, like your desire for that ends, like, don't bother me with that. Right. I don't want to, that's not like, you know, that's just under your thing. Keep that to yourself. That's also like not reality. That's not real. That's not fair. That's not good. That's not just, it's not right. and only through an intentional way of life that is completely like radical to the very like the ideas that have been ingrained in our brain since we were young. I don't know how else you can stay Christian without like, I'm not saying that grace isn't enough. I think I am trying to argue that grace is enough and Christ can transform that. But unless you are, you know, transformed by the renewal of your mind, you underestimate what Satan can do with you, because like your own culture is working against you.
Yeah.
The very idea through which you view the world. Okay. Let me just put it this way. I think this is what I've been getting at for like years, and you've really helped me. You've actually really helped clarify this tonight. The way all of us as Americans view the world is fundamentally wrong. It is not reality. And until we can admit that, I think this is what Balthasar is kind of getting at when he talks about like, how can you encounter Christ in that? That's not what he's saying. Like, how do you, there's no hope in that. There's zero hope in that. There's zero hope in that. Zero. Because you're screwed. Because it's either all about you, or it's all about these ideas, or it's all about the political state. Like, why does Saturday Night Live open up with a political sketch every freaking week now? Freaking week. It's just like, because that's what matters. That's really all that matters. Cause that's all we have. I don't even watch the first skit anymore. I cannot tell you the last time I watched the first skit on an episode of SNL. Cause I'm so exhausted by it. I don't even bother with it. I'm so exhausted. I don't care. The only political commentator I do care to pay attention to right now is Jon Stewart, because at least he's going after anyone and everything that he thinks is wrong. I don't even agree with what he thinks is right or wrong, but at least he's willing to go after Biden, and few people on the left actually are.
Yeah.
At least he's willing to do so. And he was told by Keith Olbermann and other people that he was putting democracy in danger by criticizing Joe Biden.
Yeah. So think about that.
Is that what we've come to?
When the Supreme Court issued their 9-0 unanimous decision to allow Trump into the election, Keith Olbermann called for the ending of the Supreme Court, recorded a whole thing. I watched about maybe 5 minutes of it. Of him going off on the Supreme, and he tweeted it out, so it's written. He's like, the Supreme Court has failed us as an institution. It's time to close it, or something like that. And it's like, why? Because it's violating democracy. So you want to shut down democracy? Like, it was ingenious system of checks and balances. Like, again, we go right back in the cycle.
But there's people on the right who've done the exact same thing. There are people on the right who wanted to get rid of the electoral college, and there are people on the left that, like, it's like, when it doesn't you question and it's like,
I was just thinking about that. John Gruber from Daring Fireball, when Trump got elected, I mean, he had multiple things where he was talking, whether it was on the podcast or on the his blog daringfireball.net, about how the electoral college is stupid, we need to shut it down, the majority of people did not vote for Trump, because they're trying to understand why would half the country be racist bigots, all this stuff, to vote for Trump. And maybe that's not why people voted for Trump, but they couldn't understand. No, you have to be you. So their narrative in their head was set so hard. And so their answer was, well, the Electoral College is entirely wrong and broken, and we need to get rid of it. But then when it elected Biden, all of a sudden, like, it's like, where are these like daily on the evening news shows and all this stuff? And it's like, it all went away. But then you hear some of the people on the right being like, you know, maybe the Electoral College is not the best thing. Yeah, it's so fascinating how we play these games. Like, and that, to me, that's the Republican and Democrat Party spirit. That's not even like, it's like such brazen, like, it's my team kind of thing. Like, as anything that gets my team, you know, whatever. And it's like, that's not conservatism. That's not traditionalism. That's not liberalism in the terms of like a John Stewart or a Bill Maher.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just teamism, right? That's the worst form.
But that's all that you can be when,
yeah.
Gosh, Kevin Hyder's going to kill me because that's that guy that I need to. That quote that I've sent you a text about, he was talking about tribes and stuff. And like, it's back in the 1960s, basically the hyper individualistic aspects of our culture gets rid of my identity. So all I have are just these little tribes that I'm going to cling to. When you
get rid of metaphysics, all you got is politics as the highest thing of worship.
And it just like,
I had a, let me make a connection to ministry with this real quick.
Yeah.
Is I was giving a talk on a high school retreat, and within 5 years, the diocese has become, the youth have become largely Hispanic. And so they still have the same like kind of life team model, but it's a totally different worldview now that's coming into their youth groups and stuff. So I was there and I said,
so, they brought in me.
Yeah. I honestly, I have told so many people, stop doing that. Like I went to this one church not too far from here where it's like 70% of the congregation and the parents don't even speak English, and the kids do, but the parents don't. I was like, stop bringing in me. Stop.
And I'm saying that you'd be bad.
I'm not the guy. I can acknowledge that. Right. Like,
yeah.
But I said to them, because I was, you guys, in charge,
like,
of
Merlin Mann. No. Okay. I'm going to go.
You got to rethink your life choices, guys. No, but so I said to this group, what does our modern world want? What do your parents complain about the most? And I said, when I ran Hispanic ministry at St. Anthony's, there was one thing that every mom and dad who were the first gen immigrants came here, what they told mm-hmm. me about their kids, because mm-hmm. I was in charge of youth ministry too, which was, we are so sad to see their, basically, the Mexicans were sad that the Mexican culture was completely replaced within a few months, not even years, with mass culture of America.
Yeah.
Right? Mass pop culture. And it like killed them. And so they would talk about, well, should we do this and do that? And they ended up putting on like these beautiful mother-daughter retreats that were really incredible. And it's like their daughters who were in high school started seeing their moms as human again. So that's beautiful. So I said that to the group and I said, listen, the government and big corporations want to do nothing more than to drain you of your people, your bloodline, your history, your culture. Because when it does that, it can sell you a new identity that they control. And all we tend to do as Americans lately is just derive our identity from Madison Avenue carefully constructed brands and ads and marketing. Like, we are all conceived on a storyboard in an uptown high rise. Like, honestly.
But like, that's the point of Mad Men though, right? Is that that's the American dream. That's all we are. We are a country built upon self reinvention.
Yeah.
Like going back to that thing, like, if you don't understand that, if you don't like understand, like, cause I would disagree that it's like Madison Avenue, that it is Americanism in and of itself. And that's one of the ways that it goes about. I mean, I think we are arguing the same point, but that's like, it's why it drives me nuts when people don't like Mad Men, because I'm like, which is just like,
but this is what you have when you have mass, like, exactly. You're talking about culture, but we have mass culture. We have mass media.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and what gets drowned out is the local, the individual, the family, the smallness, right? Yeah. What gets drowned out is the local. And when you have, and to me, it's fascinating when you see Wall Street companies buying Main Street businesses because it makes their portfolio look impressive.
Dangerous. It's dangerous.
Right. It really, really is. So what ends up happening, this one brilliant guy, he said, they fire us because they don't want us in their companies and they're just saving money, right? Chop people, you know, salaries cut, you know, kick people out. He goes, and then 5 years later, when the business falls apart, they end up hiring us and we say, yeah, double salary. But the whole point of that is to show that there are certain things that are local that need to be local. There are certain things that are national that can be national and international. I'm not denying that. But this is where I find the conservative MAGA Republicans and the Portland Chad progressives, like where it's like you go, this one comedian, he made this joke. He goes, okay, you on the right, you're conservatives. And then in the more center right, you're like neoconservatives. And you in the middle, you're the moderates. And you on the center left, you're the liberals. And then you on the far left, you're the progressives. And he goes, and those of you on the really far right, you're the libertarians. And those of you over here on the really far left, shockingly, you're the libertarians, right? Like it's an Ouroboros, right? The snake ends up eating itself.
Yeah.
But you see, like, when people just want to live with their families and do their thing and do this, like, with all the craziness that there is moral disagreement, like, we want clean air, clean food, you know, places of culture that are local, that our identity matters.
Yeah. And what's hard about all this, we're gonna have to wrap it up here. And I can you email me what you wrote? Because I actually went on. I think there's a lot there. I would need to do a little bit of prep on some. But I have some thoughts. I got dinner the other night with my good buddy Paul. He was in town for work, and we went. I hadn't seen Paul in 10 years. It was wonderful, and he listens to the show every now and again. And just Paul's a great guy, great guy. And first employee that I ever hired was Paul. It was great. Paul's one of the most brilliant people that I've ever met. He's a genius, speaks like Mandarin, is just thinks and things on a very high level. And he lives at, I think he's either in Cambridge or right by Cambridge, and he's just chosen to get very invested in his town. Like he's on some board, and he's like, I just go out now and I see people all the time and it's great. And I'm involved in like on the local politics and we're doing all this stuff. And I'm just like, that kind of sounds amazing. And he was like, I just have to make the choice. And what you were just talking about there, it reminded me of that, because it's like now before you had to, because you had to, because that was how you existed. And it's hard because now everything needs to be a deliberate choice.
Yeah.
Because there's 1,000 other things that you could be doing. Like going to bed here in just a bit and probably going to read a little bit more of Christopher Dawson and the Churchill biography that you got. So, which is what I'm going to do. Yeah, it just, yeah, it's, beautiful thing. I don't know. It's kind of funny because this is all stuff that we have like talked about before, but I think we need to keep unpacking this because it, everyone just feels so alone, and this is why. And until we start doing like, we reject idealism and embrace reality, and we reject individualism and we embrace community, and we are truly trying to live life in the arc. I just think you're screwed, because the very way by which you view the world could send you to hell. Which then gets to like, how culpable are you for that? You know, like I'm thinking like, how culpable are all we for this? Because since the time before we could reason through our movies, through our conversations, through our parents, through our schools, our churches, it's ingrained in our brain.
Yep. And we reinterpret Christianity accordingly instead of addressing, you know, it must have been so radical for the Christians of Rome to have to cast off Romanism, right? And to have to cast off, you know, Caesar is Lord for Jesus is Lord in order to follow the Lord. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what happens when the barbarians, though more Christianized than we think, when the barbarians are not at our gate, but have been ruling us for quite some time, as Alistair McIntyre says.
But like,
it's a whole new ball game.
It almost feels, this is extremely hyperbolic, but like that the barbarianism is our very mind.
Yeah.
The very way by which we view the world. Yeah. Right. It's insane. It's insane.
Yeah. But I guess if the gospel is truly transcultural, then there's always elements of St. Paul's dictum, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the gospel. And so it's like, yeah, like no one culture ever has it perfect, ever has it right. I just mean like, so there's always been an age there, every age will be in a certain sense, every age is the end times, right? With the collapse of the Roman Empire.
I was just about to say that. Yeah.
With the bubonic plague, with World War One, the Great War, the war to end all wars only started another. Like,
yeah.
And if you and I don't live in the atomic already, age, but the not yet. We're going to miss out.
I mean, the end of Oppenheimer, right? He believes that, that we already did, that this is just a matter of when. There is no cake. There are no candles. There's only McCarrick. Happy birthday.
Yeah. Amen.
It's so funny because like I used to view the life of the church as like the youth group, this whole, and that's true. Like, you know, your little weird committees and all the odd stuff and like the, you know, like the like old lady and the folk mass and it is all that. But it's also this like deep, deep understanding of what things are and trying to engage with both the internal and the here and now. And somehow it all can kind of work because of grace. And it's just wild. Like the church is just wild because it's like, this thing should have fallen apart so many times. And the fact that it is not is insane. It's just, it blows my mind. Sometimes I should be cast out 7 times over and somehow I'm not.
I tried. I had 1,000 signatures. It was on that government thing. What is it? What is the government website with all the funny that everyone just uses to make funny referendums? Is it change.org?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
All right, man. I love you.
To get you banned. I love
did,
you too.
Did this make sense? I just like you were having very coherent thoughts, and I'm
old, I don't know if my thoughts were coherent. I think most of our listeners are on Team Luke on this one.
I'm old stuttering Stanley here trying to read a paragraph, taking 7 minutes.
Hey, just remember, stuttering Stanley killed people.
Yeah. Today, Junior. Trying to make a child wait. Making fun of a child while he's trying to read. Are you some kind of monster? I don't know. I've been physically abused in the eon.
So, Luke, I'm going to ask you a question about stuttering that all of our fans want to know.
Yes.
Have you watched The King's Speech?
No. It makes me too I can't sit in that space for too long. It makes me too uncomfortable. I want to. It just makes me too uncomfortable.
I totally forgot about that movie, and then this audiobook that I just finished keeps referencing it of how good it is and how transformative it is.
No, I probably should, but it makes me too uncomfortable. So
fair enough.
Yeah. So what do you think? Should I keep the head unshaved?
Yes.
I don't think it looks too bad. I've got to do some stuff that'll like,
it, please. It, have you showed your sisters shave. Yet?
Yeah. They were like, Emily goes, well, now you have a chastity belt on or something like that.
She didn't make a Mr. Peanut Head comment?
No, but I like did like a side, because I did a side profile, and it looks weird on the side, because I've got to do the electric thing where it like really like gets rid of it, because you just really see all the there. Like the bumps just create this weird look where it's like, what? And what the beard being a little bit short was a bit much too, but I had to, so.
Yeah.
Wah, wah, wah. Wah, wah, wah. The good news is I have 2 very professional things on Monday and Tuesday. I'm in a new job, and the last thing I should be is unpredictable, and I just shave my head. But I one of the reasons why I did is I think it will look more professional, so.
Good. All right, homie.
Thanks to Steubenville. I'm pretty sure there's 1 more out here, so thank you guys. You guys are the best.
Oh, snap.
Love you. Stupid little comment. Don't worry. Joe's got an audio one.
Joe's got it.
Right, Joe? Yeah, Joe, you got it, buddy.
Joe's got it.
You got it. Hey, Joe's getting married.
Yes, Joe's getting married. We're so excited.
Congrats,
man.
Joe. Very happy. Not sure
where. Oh, and we owe him a bunch of advance episodes so he can enjoy his honeymoon.
Yes.
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen. Oh, silly Joe.
Silly Joe.
Silly Joe.
Oh, man. All right, homie. All right. I love you, buddy.
I love you. Good night. Bye.